My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day, my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big MQL man. Then he just kept saying things like, the more MQLs, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means marketing qualified lead. One thing's for sure, I'll be known as the MQL man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/customer to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/customer. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from The Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow The Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
I'm so excited to tell you JCPenney and country music singer-songwriter Walker Hayes are partnering together on a new limited-time men's collection for the everyday guy. What I love about Walker Hayes is his laid-back nature. He's a family man, and being a country megastar while also having seven kids, you know he likes to keep his style cool and casual. This new collection is perfect for the guy living the t-shirt life or someone wanting some fresh options that feel just as good. It's easy to wear, affordable styles that celebrate the ultimate family man, along with the quality, durability, and sensibility dads appreciate. Available online Saturday, May 4th at jcp.com and in-store Thursday, May 16th. Just in time for Father's Day. Limited time only. JCPenney, make it count.
We saw in 2008 that the global financial markets were really tied together, right, during the great financial crash. And it seems like we're only tied together even more now. So it seems like it's even worse now. And you know, with all the trouble going on in the world, I mean, obviously, yes, looking at the U.S., right, being the reserve currency of the world. But I mean, looking at what's happened in Japan with the BOJ and in Europe, I mean, if things deteriorate to a point where the EU starts to break apart or the ECB starts to default, I mean, is the Fed going to step in and put that on their back? So it's like, you kind of have to like understand what's going on there to understand what might happen to the US a little bit.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And just look at the all the currency pairs versus the US dollar. Everything's struggling. You know, the euro's down what, 20% or something in that region the last year. They've been so slow to jump on the gun with the Fed rate rises, the EU's, and I think a lot of countries is behind. And so they're just seeing that collapse. And then you've got the extra supply side inflation factor on top. Lots of interesting dynamics, putting stresses on systems. Yeah.
Yeah. I did a video not too long ago talking about, you know, potential breakup of the EU and just how, you know, just like all central banks are stuck in this proverbial rock in a hard place where inflation's raging in Europe. The inflation's worse than the US even. Inflation's raging on. So it makes it very difficult for them to, you know, continue to ease into that type of environment. But at the same time, because it's a debt-based monetary system, a Ponzi system, if they don't continue to ease and the whole thing starts to fall apart, and how Europe specifically, right, you have Germany kind of being this economic engine of Europe that's been this manufacturing hub, but then you have the pigs nations down south, right, Portugal, Italy, Greece, Spain, specifically Greece, Italy, I mean, they're horrible. Greece has had to been bailed out multiple times. And so if they continue to raise rates, how do those countries continue to get bailed out and roll over their...
Yeah. I suspect again, coming back to the US, that we're approaching the late stages of at least the aggressive part of the rate rises. I think we're going to see those rate rises diminish in size and probably pause into either later part of this year or early next year.
Okay.
Just because we're seeing inflation signs of topping the last few months, it's, you know, obviously this month individually was not what people expected, but if you look at the trend the last few months, it has come down quite a bit. And if that continues the next couple of months, I don't see why, you know, the Fed could probably, you know, quite comfortably say, you know, we've got things under control for now and let's just kind of keep things at a consistent relative level or maybe raise but less aggressively and just see if this trend continues. That's kind of my feeling. I think that will put a bit of a pressure release on systems in the next three to six months.
Let's talk about that for a minute. So inflation trending to maybe down or topping out. I saw you, I think, put out a tweet just this morning saying this is the chart to look at or something like that, right? The most bullish chart in the world, inflation top. So inflation's trending down. There was this video of President Biden that just kind of was maybe going a little bit viral. He was interviewed on 60 Minutes and they were kind of hammering him and they said, but inflation's still going. It's still moving up. And Biden said, well, it went up an inch.
Yeah.
Is it? What's an inch?
Yeah, exactly. I saw that as well. And, you know, as someone in his position, you can't, I wouldn't present it that way in the positive scenario that he tried to do, I suppose. But we do have three or four, depending if you're PPI data points now monthly on kind of reduced rates. It's still early. I think inflation is something that's probably, you know, historically it's been a problem when it arises for multiple years. So it may be that it's topped, so to speak, for now, and that we kind of level off a bit and come down maybe even to the low single digits next year. But it could then, you know, raise its head in a year or two, if depending on sort of macro situations. But I think at least for this portion of the battle, so to speak, with inflation, I think we are approaching the point where a stance softening, whether that be, you know, lower rate rises or just pausing for a few months is close. And I think you just look at the massive amount of negative sentiment we have in markets at the moment. The put call ratio is at 8 or something ridiculous, 3 times worse than 2008. There's a lot of negative sentiment and fear in the markets everywhere. And I think as soon as you have an event like that with a pause or a just reduction in rate in the level of rate rise, we're going to see a bit of a balance, I would say, at least in the near term.
Well,
risk assets.
So inflation is trending down. So it went from 9.1 to 8.5 to 8.3, right? So it's trending down. But if you dig into the data, if you look at the data, I mean the CPI data, what the government in the US is going after from the BLS, it shows that energy is the only thing that went down, right? Everything else continued to go up. And energy came down, and specifically, well, one, it had gone up. I mean, depending on if you're looking at gasoline or oil, had gone up, you know, as much as 100, 150%. And now it pulled back 20%. So it's still up 90%. So, I mean, when anything shoots up that high, it's due for a little bit back. And then you have unprecedented releasing of the SPR reserves, the oil reserves. So supply and demand, you dump all this extra supply on the market, you bring the price down 20%, you get a little bit of relief, but everything else, core still went up big time.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Energy is a huge part of it, obviously, at the moment. And that is obviously one of the driving factors of a lot of the change. But I do think also that the tightening regime that we're in, where you've got, you know, call it 3 to 5% interest rates over the next sort of 12 months, it's going to put a lot of pressure on just investments in generally, whether that be individual investors in the market, but also businesses looking to start new projects or take new actions, or any kind of speculation, any adoption risk, because you have that cash alternative, which gives you a return. So that's all going to drive down. That stuff takes many, many months to hit markets and subsequently hit consumer demand and just broader metrics of inflation that you're talking about. So, you know, we're seeing new housing starts in the US, for example. They've really come back over the last six months. Hasn't quite hit housing prices yet, but there's definitely a significant topping structure on new housings. So things like that, I think, are early signs of how people are thinking about spending money, how, you know, if people are not willing to, you know, start digging up ground because they're worried about the situation, they're starting to tighten the belt a bit. And that's going to start to feed out, I believe, into a lot of different areas of the economy. So I think we will see it in it feed into other areas, not just energy, but other areas of inflation. And it's, you know, it's a 12-month, 24-month process at least to really to see the net impacts of just where the rates are today, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. I was reading something last week and it was saying it typically takes at least 9 months to see the effects of the rate increase get its way through the market.
Exactly.
You know, and then, you know, what the Fed specifically seems to be doing is trying to destroy the demand. Right. And so whether that's crushing the real estate market to the point you're making or crushing the stock market, but they also need to really affect the employment market, right? The labor.
Yes.
Market. Yes. They're the enemy of the people. Your wages yes. going up is their problem.
Yes. That dual mandate, the kind of impossible task they have in some respects. Yeah. I think that is the biggest metric that they'd be looking at right now is employment. There's a number of, I did a tweet today, so there's about four kind of metrics at a high level or four data points that they really monitor for a recession. And that would be the key kind of help them pace how far they can push the pedal, so to speak, with tightening. But the biggest one's definitely employment. It's also, you know, you could cynically say it's voters, right? And how it impacts political power structures as well. So it's at record lows, lowest it's been in about 50 years.
You're talking about the unemployment
rate, exactly. That said, in the last 1 to 2 months, it's started to tick up a bit. Arguably nothing concerning yet, arguably noise. But if you have that trend of it continuing to go up for the next couple of months, it would look like a bottoming structure in unemployment rates. And typically when you have a bottoming structure, you do end up having a recession follow it. It's just kind of that reflexivity, basically everything compounding the wrong way. And the unemployment rates, I would say, are kind of somewhat lagging towards metrics like new housing starts, for example. But also all of this data is a bit lagging. It's monthly, and even that, the way it's aggregated, can be a bit late. So, yeah, we do need some more time to confirm that. But I think that is another reason. If that does continue its current trend of going up a bit later into the year, that's just another data point for the Fed to say, okay, now is probably a reasonable time to just see what happens if we hold rates where they are, or just, you know, increase them by 25 or 50 basis points instead of 75, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big MQL man. Then he just kept saying things like, the more MQLs, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means marketing qualified lead. One thing's for sure, I'll be known as the MQL man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/customer to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/customer. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
I bet you're smart.
Yeah, and you like to hold your own in the group chat.
We can help you drop even more knowledge. My name is Martine Powers.
And I'm Elahe Izadi. We host a daily news podcast called Post Reports.
Every weekday afternoon, Post Reports takes you inside an important and interesting story with the kind of reporting that you can only get from The Washington Post.
You can listen to Post Reports wherever you get your podcasts. Go find it now and hit follow.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. Oracle.com/strategic.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
When you look at the unemployment data, there's the data, the number that the government releases, obviously, which to your point is very low. And then there seems to be like the real data that goes into making that number. So, for example, they come up with this data by doing surveys, right? And then they have like an adjuster on top of that. So they use something like I covered this in a video, and basically they use this birth death factor to see how many new businesses were created or how many died, and then how many jobs, and then they estimate how many jobs that would create. And they do that based off of the previous year's data. So they took this anomaly year where we had this massive restart because the whole world was forced to shut down. In 2021, the world was opened back up. So we had all these businesses start back up, all these jobs. So they took that data and then extrapolated it. So they added 309,000 jobs to the data that they had. So it doesn't take a data scientist to figure out that that was an anomaly year.
Yes.
Yeah. We're grabbing an adjustment of 300,000 jobs and adding that. That's not normal. Yeah. So that data is obviously false. Do you think they look at that, or they're just looking at the data, the number?
Yeah, it's
is it about selling it to the public?
I think the latter is definitely a big part of it. I'm sure that, you know, I'd just be speculating if I guessed what they look at. I'm sure they look at a lot of different data points. That said, they don't have the best track record of identifying this stuff in advance. Even, you know, they were quite late to raising rates last year, for example. So they can be a bit behind the curve. I'm sure they've got their core metrics, which guide, may call it 60-70% of the decision making. And then you've got all this other data they probably look at as well. But the COVID situation just threw a big spike up and down in a lot of metrics. So it would be interesting to know how they allow for that. Do they smooth it out somehow? Do they just ignore it? Do they shift the data and focus on other areas? Because you're right, that will have a big impact, and we won't know for years, really, how much of an impact that could have.
Yeah. And then, well, just because when you're trying to, you know, be forward looking, you're trying to figure out like where these things are going. And so it's like, you can kind of like lie about the data for so long, but eventually like the reality is going to set in. Exactly. And so then not only that, but then we have the increase in jobs. A lot of them were part-time, less than 40 hours at lower rates. So sure, we added jobs, but we added very low quality jobs, low paying jobs, low hour jobs. So when you dig into the data, like, well, the number seems okay. The reality is kind of like the CPI. CPI came down, but when you dig into it, it actually doesn't look that good.
Yeah, I don't pretend to argue that the sort of macroeconomy as a whole is seeing a lot of trouble at the moment. Just the classic yield curves, right? They're so negatively inverted right now, which suggests that the economy is in medium to long-term trouble. And they've preceded recessions by roughly 12 months every single time, 100% hit rate over the last 70 years. So they're negatively inverted right now, which suggests that we should statistically have a recession somewhere in the next 12 to 24 months on average. So when I say that rates will potentially pause and we may have a bit of a near-term recovery in equities markets, that could last, and I don't want to put a time number, but it could last anywhere from months to a year or potentially even a bit more. And then obviously it will depend on conditions at the time. But as a whole, all of these kind of indicators are pointing towards a turn in at least the unemployment metrics, right? Which, as you say, is going to hit jobs at some point if we remain in this tightening phase.
Let's talk about the other four. You said the four signs you're looking at. So one is the unemployment data. So it is at a very low number. Whether we can believe the data or not, that's okay. At least yes. The data shows maybe the consumers are buying it. Then you had consumer spending and how strong it is.
Yeah, exactly. That was still quite strong. And I think you can see this big spike in that chart from around the corona period, which no doubt is on the back of a lot of economic stimulus and those checks that were coming out. And it is plunging right now, but it is still, at least on the data, monthly level, which again is somewhat lagging. And I think the most recent data point is a month or two old anyway, as it is on that chart. It's still about 50% above the 20-year average. But I think that's also a reflection on jobs, right? So once you see them, the unemployment rate starts to tick up, it's obviously going to impact the consumer spending. So all these metrics are intertwined. But unemployment, in my mind, is probably the most important. But yeah, we are seeing relatively healthy levels of consumer spending.
I shared this video the other day. So this is like U.S. personal savings plunging down the blue line here, and then Federal Reserve consumer credit outstanding as increasing. Yeah. We have like massive amounts of debt increasing while consumer savings going down. So the spending is happening, but where is the spending happening from?
Exactly. If you dive into the detail like a chart like this, it doesn't paint a pretty picture, that's for sure.
Yeah. So it's like the data at surface level seems to kind of be okay, right? But when you dig in, when you dig into the data a little bit, all of a sudden you're like, well, wait a minute.
But even a chart like that is another reason why at some point, unless the Fed has lost its mind, it cannot keep raising as aggressively it is, because it's just going to break not only businesses, but individuals and families which have high debt burdens. Like they could continue until things break, but I think it's some, at a logical point, especially with inflation starting to come back a bit, they're going to start to change that.
Yeah, this chart was pulled a month ago. I don't have the updated chart. This is from 8.4, you can see right here. But consumer credit skyrocketing right here, while personal savings continues to go down. So sort of like the last chart we saw, but this is a consumer credit versus personal savings. And so, spending's still happening, but I agree. I mean, unless the Federal Reserve completely has their head in the sand, they got to see this data, right? I mean,
yes. Exactly right.
Yeah. I mean, I'm certainly, I don't have the whatever thousand PhDs working for me like they do. I mean, if I can see the data, they got to see the data.
Exactly.
Then we have your next indicator was the manufacturing, the PMI holding. So that's what's the PMI and how is it holding?
Yeah, it's a survey of manufacturing. It's above 50 at the moment. It is probably one of the less attractive looking of the metrics. It's definitely come back a lot in the last 6 to 12 months. If you look at the 50 line on that metric, when it crosses under that, it's often again aligned with a period before a recession occurs. I don't have the months or the duration on top of mind, but it has occurred frequently before recession. So it's going the wrong direction. And that's, if that crosses under 50, again, another reason later in the year, early next year, to start to, reduce rates a bit, or sorry, reduce the frequency or the depth of rate rises. So yeah, it's not trending well, but it's still a positive enough level to not trigger immediate action. Yeah.
And then the fourth one was the bad one, the worst one out of all, right? Was the real
Yeah, exactly. And I haven't dived into the components of that at a great level. That said, you can see it quite clearly in a chart. The real income is very negative, far worse than 2008. And obviously a lot of that is going to be inflation related.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, it's bad, yeah.
Yeah, going back to that labor market report that I was kind of referencing before. So we saw average hourly earnings year over year go up 5% when we have 8 or 9% inflation. So wages are not going up with the rate. And back to kind of the point that we made earlier, the Fed doesn't want your wages going up. That's a problem for them.
Yes. Yes.
Man, if more people would just wake up to that fact, like the Fed actively wants you making less money.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
Because it's inflationary.
Yeah.
Inflationary.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, no, right? I mean, if I have to pay somebody more money to work, then I have to raise my prices.
Mm, exactly. Yeah.
So it seems like, and I think you would agree, that the macro picture, and you said earlier that you're kind of studying more about the US side, but the macro picture is driving the bus here. So I want to kind of dive into the risk assets. And obviously, risk assets have just been completely obliterated. November of last year, when the Fed first announced they were going to start doing it, before they even did, we saw the S&P didn't start moving until January. But when you look at risk assets and can they catch a bid? Are we at the bottom? Are they cheap or expensive? All these things. Do you think the macro picture is the one driving the bus, and that's really the bigger question overall, or where are you looking?
Yeah, it's definitely a huge factor at the moment. I think obviously my main focus is Bitcoin and crypto. When I look at Bitcoin exclusively and different valuation metrics, I look at there, many different on-chain metrics, everything is kind of screaming deep value, once in a 4-year kind of opportunity readings on multiple metrics. But we still have this tight correlation to macro markets, which is a big factor. I do think, as I mentioned, I think that a lot of the direction and trends that risk assets take in general over the long term, if you just look at big time frames, is driven by the change in rates of change of Fed and monetary policy. So we, in November last year, as you mentioned, where they basically announced we're going to have a rate of change in how rates are increased, and that triggered this kind of collapse. And I think we're about to see the next kind of transition later this year, early next year, where the rate of change of rates will reduce or go to zero. So the rates will just go, you know, pause at the current level, at least for some time. And then that will cause a kind of a trend shift in risk assets. Again, may not be long term, but I think it will happen. And it could be that we're in a recession at that point, or maybe it's a bit later or earlier. But people have to remember that historically, once a recession is announced, it has been a pretty good buy signal in risk asset markets. So while things may look awful, while unemployment may be rising, it doesn't make, you know, the equities market's always looking forward. They're always discounting back 6-12 months from the future. So even if situations are quite ugly, it's going to be the rate changes that drive things. So I think that's on the horizon. I think this Wednesday, so we're on, you know, Monday today. So on Wednesday, we've got the rates being announced. It's about 80% priced in that we're going to have a 75 basis point rate rise, 20%, 100. I don't think 100 is even on the cards, just given we've got inflation coming back and where all these other data points are at that we're talking about, all these red flags. So I think once that 20% is eliminated of the extremity in rate rises, you'll see a small sort of rally in markets, depending, of course, on the narrative that Jerome Powell presents. But I think that's the base case.
How dovish or hawkish he is.
Exactly. Like if they raise by 75, and then he just drops the hammer that, I don't know, extremely negative and pessimistic, then I don't think we're going to get much reaction. But I think that he probably will keep the similar narrative to last time, but it'll be 75. That cuts out the risk of the 100. we get a small rally, and then the next months, if situations continue as is, if inflation continues to top, we get some more recovery there in risk assets.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
This summer, click into Memorial Day savings at the Home Depot and get after those outdoor projects with some serious cordless power from Ryobi. Tackle more than half an acre of grass with the convenience and gas-like power of the Ryobi 40-volt battery-powered mower. Leaves and debris are no match for the 40-volt power of the Ryobi leaf blower. No cords, no gas, no hassle. Tidy up those flower beds and keep your walkways looking sharp with Ryobi's 40-volt cordless string trimmer. Yard work, done and done. Click into Memorial Day savings happening now at your cordless power source, the Home Depot. Shop now at the Home Depot or homedepot.com. How doers get more done.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union, a savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
So that's kind of my base case. And then when I think about that in line with where the deep value I see is in Bitcoin and crypto, I think that we've got a great opportunity at the moment, that those opportunities can last a while. Prices can obviously always go lower. But generally speaking, I feel like it's basically a buy side opportunity in the next 6 to 12 months if you're allocating to an asset class like crypto, for example. And crypto is like the beta or extra beta risk on equities. So we have even seen the last sort of few weeks, I was looking at a chart today actually, that it's starting, you know, there's obviously that tight correlation with equities, but we're starting to see Bitcoin moving first in terms of risk. So it's being priced as a pure risk asset, even more so than equities. I don't expect that to last long term, but we should see impacts at least near term sooner in the crypto space.
So we're talking about the risk assets really being affected by this. I think I've made some statements. I've seen you put out some tweets as well, which is like, you know, Bitcoin's trading like a risk on asset, but it's not a risk on asset. Exactly. So it's trading like that, but it's not. We're always looking for the mismatch of perception and reality.
Yeah,
I saw an article came out from the guys over at Bloomberg Intelligence, and they said that they thought they could see Bitcoin moving to trade more of a risk off asset by Q4 of 2022.
Yeah,
and maybe move more towards like a bond or gold kind of a format. What do you see as far as that mismatch? I mean, is it being traded like that, but it's not? I mean, what's that perception there?
And yeah,
that leak out.
Yeah, that's something I've been thinking about a lot. I think there is a big misalignment or a big perception gap in what Bitcoin, specifically Bitcoin, is. It's more or less designed for exactly this macroeconomic issues that we're facing right now. It's hard-coded for 100 years. We know what the inflation rate is going to be. We know it's lower than gold and every other alternative until, we could talk about Ethereum. But generally speaking, it's super low, rock solid inflation policy, inflation hedge, a preserver of value, but it's been traded the exact opposite. Even though we have 10 years of data, which shows that it has the highest risk-adjusted returns of all asset classes, it's being treated as just pure speculation by, and my belief is it's just primarily the institutions that have entered the market in the last 18, 24 months or so. And their allocations are probably, you know, 1%, 2% or whatever it may be, but relatively small compared to their overall portfolio. And they, and people in general don't fully understand what Bitcoin is yet. People are still working out how to value it. There's new metrics coming out all the time. There's always disagreements on what's better or worse in doing that. And because of that, it just gets lumped into the speculation bin. And if there's any risk in overall markets, that's the first thing to go, is where I see it at the moment. That's why we see Bitcoin trading like basically junk in an environment it was perfectly built for. And it's interesting you mentioned that report for Q4 and that it could change and that you know, a bit more like gold. And I do think that will happen. I don't know if it's Q4 because I haven't seen the evidence of it happen yet. It could be a long time, so I can't put a time on it, but I do think there'll be a drastic shift, basically an inversion of that how it's perceived and how it trades and that correlation. It's also like, if you look at the 10 years of Bitcoin, the correlation with Bitcoin to all other equities markets, for example, is it fluctuates around zero pretty much that whole time, except for the last 12 to 18 months, which again aligns with that window of when institutions have started to adopt or at least get involved with Bitcoin. So I think it's like a learning phase. Perhaps it will require a shift in macro markets. Perhaps it requires just time to resolve, but I think it does resolve at some point.
I want to dig more into that, and I have a couple tweets that you had put out that I want to discuss. But I know that your fund is trading Bitcoin. You're trying to create alpha, better returns than Bitcoin itself, buy and hold strategy. So the big question is, I saw you were in a Spaces not too long ago, and I didn't get to listen to it, but I saw I think the title was Bitcoin to 12,000 or 30,000, which happens first?
yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So as somebody who's trading Bitcoin and trying to generate alpha on top of Bitcoin, what do you think comes first, 12,000 or 30,000?
Yeah.
And does it matter?
Yeah. So I can answer that question with my personal opinion, but it doesn't really reflect how we manage our capital. So that's one thing. We deploy kind of a variety of quantitative strategies across different assets in the crypto space. The overall goal is to outperform Bitcoin long-term. But yeah, from a personal opinion, when I look at these deep value ratings I'm seeing, when I just look at the technicals of where the chart is, I would say, you know, and given now where I think macro is in leading into the end of the year, early next year, I think that the risk reward is definitely skewed to the upside. I don't see why we couldn't necessarily take out the lows of price, so in the 17s, for example. But if I had to, you know, put my money on it, which I wouldn't make a bet like this, but if I did, I would say that the mid to high 20s comes before the, you know, the low teens, for example, in price. But yeah, again, that's not how we we manage a capital. But I just see so much, as I've mentioned, so much negative sentiment, so much fear in the market. Everything's priced for the downside. I see that in the next 6 to 9 months, call it, we have a regime change in macro. And then I see 1 in 4 year value opportunities in Bitcoin. And for me, that just says that, you know, the risk reward is drastically to the upside. And also this asset class is still so misunderstood. So you add that on top at some point, we don't know when, but once that changes, and I'm sure it will in the coming years, that will again add another factor of potential appreciation.
Yeah, I think the longer term picture seems easier to decipher. The short term picture is hard. It's like a lot of people and even the market you were kind of referring to earlier about the shorts and the longs and whatnot in the options market, I think. But overall sentiment seems to think the market, like the whole world's going to end. And, you know, the market could easily drop 50% from here, which they could.
Exactly.
You know, you got plenty of people calling for that. you know, some of them have been calling it for a decade, you know, we got the Jeremy Granthams or whatever saying, you know, we're at a textbook 50% retracement. We're about to have another big plunge. Of course, we got Harry Dent, who's been calling it for a decade, and we have those people. If we saw the markets plunge another 50% from here, then I guess the $12,000 Bitcoin comes into play. But maybe we don't. Maybe we don't see that. And I think there's definitely a camp for that argument as well. If you zoom out and look at like a weekly chart of the NASDAQ and the S&P 500, they're holding their trend line like perfectly. Is that kind of how you see it, back to kind of the point we made earlier, right? Like the macro is driving the bus. So like if the markets plunge 50% from here, then probably that 12,000 comes into play. And so I guess you'd have to ask yourself, do you think the markets plunge 50% from here? Or do you think they kind of the rates pause, and maybe we kind of hold this market structure?
Yeah. So I basically agree with what you're saying. And you know, if it also depends on timing, if we finish this meeting and markets drop 50%, then probably we're going to look at Bitcoin chart and be a bloodbath.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's not my base case. Definitely wouldn't be surprised to see some downside volatility. But I do think that, as I mentioned, you know, if you give it a few months, and I think that the trend will be, you know, we might have this consolidation phase where we're in right now, which we have had for 3 months really, but I think as I mentioned, the risk reward is more or less to the upside. It also depends on your time horizon as an investor. If you're trading this on a day-to-day level, then you know, you could argue either way very, very easily. But if you're talking about years, then again, for me, it all stacks up to the upside.
Let's talk about some of your metrics that you look at. So I know you're looking at these hash ribbons, and on-chain metrics is some of the tools that you use. The hash ribbons, that's regarding the miners and what the miners are doing?
Yeah, exactly. So the hash ribbons is, you know, simply described, basically looking at the trends in hash rate. And hash rate is a measure of basically how much mining energy is committed to the network, how much security it has. So Hashrooms itself is just looking for major capitulations in hash rate. And that usually happens when you've had some kind of hit to price, or could be even to supply side. You may have rising energy prices like we have globally, which cause the profit margins of Bitcoin miners to get squeezed. And at some point, the inefficient miners kind of stop mining, or they give up, or they sell their Bitcoin stack to cover their costs. And that creates extra sell side pressure. Price kind of takes another leg down. At some point, that basis, you're left with the most efficient miners, and then you start to get a recovery. And when you get that recovery along with kind of price recovery, it's been a good buy signal in the past. So we had that occur in, I think it's about 3 or 4 weeks ago now, hash ribbon buy. Which is a strong multi-month, call it, buy signal. This one also happens to be in the later part of the Bitcoin halving cycle, and those ones historically have been the best performant. That said, comparing miners today to 4 years ago, they're relatively a smaller element of the network, simply because we have so many other big players, so many big institutions, investors, companies like MicroStrategy, et cetera, that add, you know, they control quite a bit of supply too. So we should expect that into the future, the miners may have less impact in overall price direction than they did in the past. I still think the signal is valid. It's still impacting our portfolio to the positive side. But it's not the complete, it's not the only thing we look at. Bitcoin investing in general is a lot more sophisticated today. I think you need to consider a lot more data points. Also, obviously, macros we've discussed most of today. So it's one element. It's, if I had to choose one metric and only invest based on that metric, it would still be that one today.
But the hash-ribbon one.
Exactly. If I could only choose one thing to buy, it would be based on that. But it wouldn't be wise to base your decisions purely based on that one.
Yeah, never. There's never one indicator that's a conclusive.
Exactly.
Never.
Yeah.
You need as many indicators as you possibly can find.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, deputy opinion editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
This summer, click into Memorial Day savings at the Home Depot and get after those outdoor projects with some serious cordless power from Ryobi. Tackle more than half an acre of grass with the convenience and gas-like power of the Ryobi 40-volt battery-powered mower. Leaves and debris are no match for the 40-volt power of the Ryobi leaf blower. No cords, no gas, no hassle. Tidy up those flower beds and keep your walkways looking sharp with Ryobi's 40-volt cordless string trimmer. Yard work, done and done. Click into Memorial Day savings happening now at your cordless power source, the Home Depot. Shop now at the Home Depot or homedepot.com. How doers get more done.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cash back on purchases. And pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
When it comes to the hash ribbons, I understand what you're saying. So you have now these big institutions who are holding considerable amounts of Bitcoin, hundreds of thousands of Bitcoins at a time, and, you know, potentially never putting them back into the market, right? And so markets, you know, price action moves on supply and demand. So if you have these, you know, big institutions, the MicroStrategies buying the Bitcoin, locking it away in cold storage, and never goes back up, then that affects the supply-demand metric. The miners, although to your point you're making, I can see that, right, which is... they're not the big institutions anymore. Now we have the big publicly traded institutions, et cetera. However, the miners are the ones producing it, right? So if they're going to sell everything they produce every day or every month or quarter, then we still have that pressure that's constantly on the price action. Whereas if they decide to hold, then that takes all that new supply off the market or a considerable piece. So, to your point, I mean, I see what you're saying. I think I haven't studied the hash ribbons as in depth as you have, I'm sure. But just thinking through it just quickly, it seems like what that new supply does every day, week, month, or quarter probably has a lot to do with that price action. So we did see the miners capitulate, which actually I had thought maybe was a sign of the bottom, right? So we had the cascading effect from Terra Luna to Celsius and Voyager and all that, boom, 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 boom. And then the miners were forced to capitulate, and it looked like they had sold everything plus some of their, you know, at least what we saw from the publicly traded ones. And so now it does the hash ribbon, is that what that picks up as well? The miner capitulation, or does it pick up their machines coming online and offline?
Both. They're all kind of incorporating the hash rate. And I agree with everything you just said, that it still has a big impact. They still are a big influencer, I would say, on price and network, of course. I kind of think if you look at it, you know, the inflation curve of Bitcoin is kind of a logarithmic curve to zero, more or less, over 100 years. And their impact kind of, or their relative impact in the network follows that chart. And that inflation rate for Bitcoin obviously halves every 4 years. So, you know, in 2024, so in 2 years from now, they're going to have half as much in new supply coming in. So the relative impact they have in the network from a supply side will reduce with time. So I still think it's very relevant, just a bit less than 2 years ago, but a lot more than it will be in 2 years' time. The interesting thing, though, is that a lot of these things, a capitulation, occur at the same time. So you just mentioned, you know, I think 3SC and all these bankruptcies and Celsius and other lending platforms just blowing up. in the last couple of months. And it was exactly in that window that the miners were also going through the capitulation. So when they're struggling, it tends to be obviously that other large institutions are struggling from similar kind of price stress.
All right. What about the on-chain data? Do you think the hash? I mean, I guess the hash ribbons are on-chain data as well. And I guess you've already said that that's like probably your number one metric that you're looking at. Are there other on-chain data metrics that you think are pretty important?
Definitely. We run one strategy on our portfolio, which only looks at on-chain and some macro market metrics. So it looks at over 35 of them. To basically go long or into cash with that portfolio every day. And it just reweights them using a machine learning algorithm to find which have been most predictive of price, essentially. So there's definitely value in it. Also just published a very short article a couple of days ago on SLRV ribbons, which is super basic metric on the SLRV ratio, which is essentially the ratio of short-term holders to long-term holders and the relative activity in the network. So when you have these big bubbles in Bitcoin, you know, for example, going up to 20K in 2017, up to 60K more recently, you have a lot of active short-term holders. They turn over their coins, they're holding it, you know, for days, short periods of time. And then when prices collapse, you often see the short-term traders and speculators kind of disappear from the market. And you're left with the long-term holders or those that hold for, you know, 6 months or more. And that's kind of what forms the base. So in markets, when that ratio between short and long-term, it kind of just oscillates, right? And we're at that bottom point kind of now where you have a lot of long-term holder activity, almost no short-term holder activity. And it tends to, the new cycle or the new, you know, kind of sustainable price recovery tends to occur when you do start to get that kind of new growth, that new grassroots movement from short-term holders entering the market again, regaining interest, because that is also obviously associated with new wallets being created on the network. So the just general network adoption of Bitcoin. So the trend is still to the downside on that metric, which again, that can be lagging. It's not going to time perfect tops and bottoms. But it does give good times to risk on and risk off. And generally speaking, where the metric is at in terms of level, it's below 0.04, which is historically, again, lines up with the bottom of most Bitcoin bear cycles. So that's just one example of a metric. The article I wrote on it just created a very basic strategy to long and go to cash using that metric, and it outperforms Bitcoin by 3 times in the last 5 years and it has 30% less downdraw. So it's just one example. It's not meant to be an isolated trading strategy, but it just shows that there is value in on-chain. And yeah, we definitely look at it quite closely in our approach.
So to kind of summarize all of this, the macro picture is the one driving the bus. So keep an eye on that. If we look at the indicators, hash ribbons, as well as like on-chain data, I'll put out a couple of videos on it as well. Finding Bitcoin's fair market value, looking at the, age of coins moving, things like that. It looks like anything under 20,000 is USD is a pretty generational buying opportunity. Bitcoin's valuation is historically cheap. We don't know when bottoms come until we're looking backwards on them. So we just typically try to buy when it's cheap and sell when it's expensive, or if you're a trader, or add to your portfolio by buying when things are cheap. And we can see it's historically cheap. Doesn't mean it can't get cheaper and doesn't mean it can't stay cheap for a long time, right?
Exactly.
That kind of the overall picture that you see.
Yeah, that's perfectly summarized. And I think regardless of when you enter the market in crypto, you have to come in with a long-term mindset of at least try and if you're just going to buy and hold, at least have that 4 year, that full cycle in mind. And this is my personal opinion anyway, not
a 4 year or a full year.
Yeah, 4 years is the Bitcoin halving cycle. And I think that is a good way to capture, good opportunities, I would say, and expect sizable downdraws. 50% plus shouldn't be unexpected. Even if you enter now, I don't think you're going to see that kind of level of downdraws we've already talked about, but you should be prepared for it, and not, that shouldn't be your opportunity to exit, I suppose, at a loss. But yeah, of course, it really depends on anyone's individual investment objective. But yeah, I do see huge value on the Bitcoin side, the on-chain side, cycle timing. We're also between years 2 and 3, which has always been the bottom for Bitcoin. We've hit 90% of normal cycle down draws. And then on top of that, I believe we have a shift change in macro coming. Also, at some point, it's going to decouple from macro. So assuming the fundamentals for Bitcoin remain healthy, assuming we don't have people just abandoning network, but you know, long-term holds continue to grow, most metrics of undervaluation continue to remain strong. At some point, every incremental drop in macro or equities isn't going to have the same magnitude of impact on Bitcoin. So there is a point where, you know, and Bitcoin, if everything kind of kept falling, its market size becomes smaller and smaller. And it just, there's a point where it just breaks apart. And I think in that, you know, call it decoupling or just at least lessened correlations, it will behave differently as it has always in the past.
Yeah, I agree. So at some point it's going to decouple. The perception of reality is going to catch up. And I think we're seeing that, you know, the dollar index being so strong, it's just wiping out currencies all around the world. And those currencies are failing and people are jumping ship, trying to put their value into anything other than those local currencies. And a lot of them are moving to Bitcoin because of the permissionless, borderless aspect of it. And so maybe it's controlled by the US entities, but the rest of the world's kind of waking up and moving to it. And so eventually that tide will shift. But yeah, well, good content. I appreciate the time going through that. I think we'll wrap it up right there. I want to make sure in the notes down below for everyone listening, we'll link your Twitter account. I have that Medium article you put together about those ribbons. We'll link to that as well. Anything else that you want to shout out?
No, that's it. It's been my pleasure, Mark. Always good to chat markets with you. Yeah, you can obviously check out, I'm most active on Twitter. Otherwise, you can get in touch via my website, caprioli.com. But yeah, been my pleasure. And thank you very much for the time today.
All right, thanks. Check that out in the links down below. And thanks for listening.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350 plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.